Hello, welcome back to another edition of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? I am your host, L. Ariel, and we can be found at musicjobspodcast.com. That's musicjobs with an S, podcast.com. We're also on all the streaming platforms, Google Play, iTunes, Stitcher, Podcast, iHeartRadio, TuneIn, and more. If you are listening to us on one of those streaming platforms, we would love, love, love if you could give us some stars, show us some love, give us some feedback, tell us if we suck, tell us if we're great, but please give us some feedback so we can get bumped up in the rankings and more people can find out all about this podcast and how they too can have a career in music, how people do get their music jobs. That's right. We talked to the movers and shakers and innovators in the music industry today, find out all about their career trajectories, the decisions they made, the risks they took, the obstacles they faced, and any advice and insight that they have to share. And it's usually a lot of really, really good stuff. Last episode, I had Kevin Nixon and Sarah Clayman, founders of Dime Music Institute. They have locations in Detroit and Denver and also courses online, but they are all about preparing music students for the modern music industry. That's right. They're all about helping students prepare for a sustainable long-term career in the music industry. So just a really great podcast, a lot of good nuggets of wisdom. So go on back and listen to that if you haven't had a chance to already. My guest this week is Jeff Weiss. He is a writer and journalist, founder of the online music magazine Passion of the Weiss. He also runs a record label. He is the co-author of the book Tupac versus Biggie, an illustrated history of rap's greatest battle. He is also founder of the soon-to-be-launched The Land magazine and so much more, which he is going to tell you all about really soon. But first, we're going to start with a favorite track of his. It's Ion Rap Beef by Draco the Ruler featuring O3 Greedo. Here we go.
All mud in the phrase a nigga saying I'm a addict. Rap dealing with some things you perceive as post-traumatic. I'm a roll runner, should be posing for ballot. Ion Rap Beef, if it's on, I'm a crash. All mud in the phrase a nigga saying I'm a addict. Dealing with some things you perceive as post-traumatic. I'm a roll runner, should be posing for ballot. Don't rap beef, if it's on, I'ma crash you. Don't add me, fuck it, please, bro, add me. They gon' have to find a suitable picture for Fox 11. You ain't learned from Cold Devil, I'm a nuisance, I'm telling. Took a mud walk through Nemus like I got a special power. I got dirty money,
hey,
on
Jeff,
me, but I just got
out. Thank you for joining me on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? Thanks for being here.
I'm glad to be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Tell me your first memory of music.
There are, I remember, like, songs, you know, like, catching you in your childhood, but like the thing that really strikes me was, so I grew up in a house where there was literally one record, which is insane to think, but there was one album in my house, and it was Michael Jackson's Thriller, which is very much like you are an 80s baby when that is your one album. But I feel like that's probably like the one album to have, you know, like if like you're gonna pick one album, probably like the greatest pop R&B soul album of all time, or if not the greatest, then like top five. So that was the one, and I would just listen to Michael Jackson's Thriller like over and over and over again, and I like was obsessed with Michael Jackson. He was like my favorite, you know, and I think on some level, like, that is probably where like my love of hip-hop comes from. Like despite what some people might think, like, I actually really like popular music, like when it's good, you know. To me, that's like the best. To me, those are my favorite things, when something is really good and really popular. And like, I think Michael Jackson really kind of hits that sweet spot where it's like, oh, this is the most popular album of all time, but it's just banger after banger after banger. I mean, it's really tragic, the whole Michael Jackson saga that follows. But, you know, when I was just a little kid, like, seeing him, he just was like larger than life. You know, you're like, Halloween is Michael Jackson, it's Thriller, you know, like, it just, he was the guy, you know, like the Moonwalker video game, you know, like Captain EO at Disneyland. He just was, you know, it's like, he just was my everything.
Yeah, well, right, I'm right there with you. I'm totally right there with you.
Yeah, you're big Michael Jackson.
Oh my God, like, I used to buy the trashy tablets just to cut out pictures of Michael.
Yeah, yeah.
And then I wrote, when his hair caught on fire, I wrote him a letter, and I was all mad that my letter wasn't the one that he read. Remember, there was one that was like, I knew you were hot, but this is ridiculous. I'm like, that's stupid. I could have come up with something so much better.
I feel like that is a terrible double entendre.
Right, exactly.
Like, I'm so, 7, and even I know that's not funny. Like, totally.
Totally. Did you have any musical aspirations? Were you taking lessons or anything like that?
No, never. That's like the funny thing. That's the funniest thing where people be like, oh, all music writers are failed musicians. I was like, no, definitely not. Like, I never, like I freestyled in college. You know what I mean? Like, but there was never, like, a day in my life where I was like, I am going to be a musician. Like, no, like, I didn't play the guitar. Like, I didn't grow up in a musical house. Like, I was a jock. Mm-hmm. Like, I played college baseball. Like, I played baseball and basketball in high school. You know, that was my whole life, honestly. I just happened to love music. It was something that, yeah, I mean, honestly, I loved, like, for the first, you know, 15 years of my life, or up until I was about 12, it was just, all books and sports and, like, video games. And then when I turned, like, I guess it had to be when I just turned 11 and, like, The Chronic came out. I was like, okay, well, that's it. Sign me up. Whatever this doctor, whatever's going on in the Nothing But a G Thing video, it's good. So then I was 11 and I bought a lowrider, and that was my first arrest. So I was that, and I just, like, fell in love with hip-hop, you know, like The Chronic and Doggy Style, and, like, Warren G's album when that came out, and just, you know, everything. I just, you know, I would watch, like, Yo MTV Raps. And I would watch BT Rhapsody when I was a little older, and, like, I had, like, every cassette, and, you know, like, I'd beg my mom to, like, you know, and I'd, you know, I was always, like, trying to, like, amass, like, a music collection, but, like, my family would never, like, you know, never want it for anything, but my parents certainly weren't about to, like, you know, give me, like, here's $100, go to the music store. So I'd be, you know, buying used CDs, like, I'd be, like, desperately, like, going to all these stores, like, hoping I could find, like, the Outkast AT Aliens record for, like, $6.99 at the warehouse in Westwood or something, you know, so that was sort of, like, my childhood, how music kind of came about.
Mm-hmm. So when you were looking at colleges, now you're saying you played baseball, was it just, like, I'm just going to get a scholarship and a sports scholarship to college, or what was that?
I got, an academic scholarship to Occidental College, like, partial, but it was, you know, it was, like, partially, I think, because of sports. It's a D3, so they don't give out athletic scholarships, but, like, it was, like, one of those things where, like, oh, if you're going to, you know, I was going to play basketball there, too. And I showed up there, and I was, like, they ended up actually going to the Elite Eight for Division III, and, like, I showed up there, and I was, like, I could make the team, but I'm not going to start. So I wanted to go to a Division III because I was a year younger than almost everybody in my grade. So it was sort of a late, late in developing, just, you know, and so I wanted to go to Division III and ultimately transfer to Division I, but I don't know. Evan was taking steroids, and I decided not to take steroids, and I think I'm probably better for it now. But, yeah, so, I mean, it was cool. I started as a freshman, and, like, you know, I played, like, 3 years of varsity and was a pitcher in the first baseman and like, hit cleanup, and it was awesome. And then, like, we had a team walkout, and that's sort of when I became a writer, because it was, like, my junior year of college. It's really crazy, and, like, I'm probably still going to write about it one day. But basically, like, you know, it was just a wild year. Like, one of our teammates was in the Marines and was going to go to Afghanistan, so that was, like, really traumatic, and, like, 9/11 happened, and then, like, it was just, like, a crazy year. And then what happened was one of our there was, like, a fraternity at my college, and there were a few, but one of the fraternities was, like, all baseball and football players, and there were all these freshmen that had pledged this fraternity, and they got sent on a hazing trip to Vegas, and basically the car crash. I don't know if they were drunk or not. I heard they weren't drunk. But it was like a hazing trip. They got sent to Vegas. The driver crashed. Starting shortstop, who was 18 years old, died. The driver was our, like, reserve left fielder. You know, one of my best friends had just been cut, but he was on the team the year before. He, like, suffered brain damage and was nearly paralyzed. Another guy was a football player that got paralyzed. So it was just this really traumatic experience that scarred us. And then we had a team walk out, like, 2 months later. So that's, like, stopped playing baseball. And I started writing a book basically about the hazing at this school and the accident. And because I'd pledged the fraternity but depledged it before I became active, because I didn't know what a fraternity was. And, like, I was like, oh, that, like, sounds like a fun thing. Like, I didn't know I literally had no idea what a fraternity was. Like, I just, like, I knew, like, my dad had been one for, like, a year and then left it. And I was like, okay. And then I joined it, and it was like, these guys are, like, really misogynistic and kind of, like, violent, and just, I mean, there were some good guys in it. Like, I shouldn't, like, tarnish the whole one, but there were some really bad guys in it. And so I wrote a book kind of about how much I hated fraternities and how I blamed fraternities for kind of killing my friend. Mm-hmm. So that kind of, like, kickstarted me, like, being a writer. I mean, I already kind of, like, thought about doing it. You know, I was dating a girl from the Bay Area at the time. So we'd go, you know, on breaks, I'd go and visit her in the Bay, and like we'd go to City Lights Books and like Shakespeare and Company and like the East Bay, and you know, it just really like kind of galvanized this like love of reading that I'd had when I was a kid. But I didn't know that there were, you know, like my family wasn't a literary family. My family wasn't a music family. Like my dad was a lawyer. My mom was a housewife and had like a baby business, like selling baby clothing. And, you know, education was prioritized, but it wasn't like, you know, anyone had, you know, I think there was like one book in my house that belonged to my parents that wasn't mine. And it was like the Firm, you know? So it wasn't like, I didn't know what books. So then like, you know, when I was in college, people were like, oh, you know, here are the beats. And that to me was like, whoa, you can write like this? I had no idea. You know, like I was like, that's amazing. These are adult books that I love. And so then, you know, paired with that and this like traumatic experience with the accident, and all of a sudden I'm stopping playing baseball because we had this team walkout, which is a whole long convoluted story. And then I was like, okay, I'm graduating college and I'm working on this novel and I guess I'm a writer. So my dad's like, all right, get a job, you know? And so then that was the last like 15 years of my life, more or less, you know?
Well, walk us through that. Cause it's like, I think some people get traumatized just by graduating from college and not knowing what the hell they're going to do. Yeah.
I mean, like that's a trauma. I mean, yeah, like I have a lot of empathy for people that are just graduating college. It's a terrifying time. You're very depressed. You don't necessarily have the tools to cope with that depression. And I mean, if anything, like I would say mental health is like one of the most number one important things you can do for yourself as any kind of creative person, or really any kind of human. But like, especially if you're like someone that thinks a lot, you know, the world is like meant to drive you crazy at this point, or at least it seems like, at least that, you know, this like inherently schizophrenic divide between like the digital world and your everyday life, which is like much slower, you know, at least for me in LA. And like, then you go on the internet and you're like, it's like this like labyrinth of toxicity, just like, fuck. So I graduated and I didn't know what to do. I was like writing a novel. Like I had like really grandiose, ambitious dreams of like being a novelist, which like on some level, like I still do. You know, I was working on a book last year, but well, I'm gonna get back to it in the next year, but this was a crazy year. But so yeah, I graduated. Tried to figure out what the fuck to do. Had like a million odd jobs, too many to even name. It was just like, you know, tutoring and like, it was like receptionist in my dad's law office, which did not end well. I was like writing some women's term papers. Just, I mean, everything. Just like, it was just nonstop. Just like working, and then writing at night on this book. And then I guess like my real like first break was sort of my dad knew, you know, it was before the internet really existed in like the form that exists now. Like my dad had a friend that knew a woman that was the publisher of a business newspaper in the San Fernando Valley. And I was at the time, you know, of course I wanted to be, oh, I should be at the LA Times. I should be at the LA Weekly. I should be Rolling Stone. I should be at Pitchfork. And you know, I was 21 and I was like, I don't think so. So I applied to this business journal, this San Fernando Valley Business Journal. And the publisher was a very kind and generous woman. And she was like, sure, let me refer you to the editor and we'll see if they need someone. You know, we are always looking for like smart young people that will write for free. So I started writing for free for about 4 or 5 months for them. I mean, the most boring stuff, you know, like they have the top 50 educators in the Valley or something, you know, or the do a list or interview this manufacturer, you know, like this guy who's making like, you know, widgets for the defense industry in Chatsworth, right? So I would do that.
Right.
And eventually they're like, you want a full-time staff job? And they're like, yeah, you'll get paid 28 grand a year. I'm like, great, sign me up. So I did that for about a year and a half. And, you know, it was a really formative experience for me. It taught me how to be a reporter. I got really got like the sensei treatment from my editor at the time, was a man named Jason Schaff, who I will forever be indebted to, because he, you know, he just put me through the ringer, and it was really difficult. You know, I had to wear a suit every day, which like was, I wanted to strangle myself with my tie. And, but I did it, and it was like a day job, and I realized kind of how much I hated having a day job, reading like Allen Ginsberg poetry compilations, like in like this windy, like office center, like this like wind tunnel of these skyscrapers in Woodland Hills, and it'd be like Woodland Hills, so it's like kind of like extreme, it'd be like strong gusts of wind, and I'm like, my tie is going everywhere, and I'm like going into my like tostada or something, and I'm like, ah, what am I doing? You know, it's like reading like F. Scott Fitzgerald's Inside of Paradise, and I was like writing a novel at night, and it was like a very like romantic and tormented and depressive time. And so I I was doing that, and then I it had to be, I guess, it was 2005, and I started reading all these, like, blogs that I thought were great. You know, like, I liked Aquarium Drunkard and Girl vs. Bear, but, like, also my friend Ian Cohn had a blog called Sexy Results, and there was a guy named Joey that had a blog called, like, Straight Bangin'. It was, like, a rap and hip-hop blog, and, you know, it was, like, Free Darko, and there were, like, all these really cool blogs, and people were writing about things that I didn't know that anyone, like, I grew up, in a way, in a very close environment. I wasn't like an internet person, you know. I wasn't on message boards. I didn't know about any of this. Like, I was like, yeah, I love Wu-Tang. Like, I love Ghostface Killah. You know, I know every word to, you know, these songs, and, you know, I loved rap. And it was cool to kind of find a community of people that existed other than, like, my four friends that, like, loved rap, you know. And, you know, driving around, like, listening to, like, Tribe Called Quest and Jay-Z in high school or whatever, Bone Thugs. And I thought it was really cool. And I was just really bored at work one day, and I was like, okay, well, I guess I'm just going to start this blog, because when your novel is done, all these agents are going to be like, well, do you have an internet presence? Like, I had the wherewithal even at that time, like in the 2005, to be like, yeah, you probably need, like, an internet presence. So I started Passion of the Wife, and that had to be, you know, it was like the late summer, early fall of 2005, and it was, I mean, it's embarrassingly bad, and, like, they're all gone, all those posts, and they're, like, they're really horrible and embarrassed, and just, you know, awful. But, like, you know what, that's fine. Like, I think that's, like, one thing that, like, kind of, like, really is upsetting about, you know, and maybe I'm, like, being hypocritical, because sometimes I'll criticize musicians, you know, for the stuff that they make when they're super young. I try to avoid it, but at the same time, like, I feel like a lot of musicians peak by the time they're 25, so, like, it's a kind of a different art form, but, like, writers don't even really start to hit the prime usually until they're, like, at least 30. You know, I think every art form is just different. Like, I mean, like, to poets, like, very often peak at, like, 23, you know? And I think, like, music is more tied to poetry in that regard. You know, it's like, you always think of Rimbo, like, writing all those amazing poems at, like, 18. I mean, even Allen Ginsberg, like, you know, his best stuff is in his early 30s. Yeah, so I just did that in the blog. You know, I quit my job in early 2006, and I had some money saved up. And I was just like, well, you have enough money for, like, 6 months to a year, like a year if you can get some work, and like 6 months if you just, you know, or, you know, totally like just devoted to working on your book, you know, taking other jobs. And you're like, if I, and I said to myself, I was like, well, if I can't, by the end of this year, if I can't get to the LA Times or the LA Weekly or something similar to that, then I probably don't deserve to. And at this time, I was writing for a magazine called Stylist Magazine. You know, it was run by this really brilliant editor named Todd Burns, who now works at the Red Bull Music Academy. And I met these incredible, incredible friends and colleagues and peers at Stylist Magazine. Like, too many to name, honestly. But they're like some of my dearest friends to this day. And I owe so much of, like, my intellectual and music education to just being on a message board with these other brilliant writers. You know, them, like, having to argue with them and just feeling really hopelessly naive and uneducated. And, you know, I knew rap, but I didn't know about jazz. I didn't know about the blues. I didn't know about, like, psychedelic rock. And, I'd been educating myself in psychedelic rock over the last, but I still didn't know, like, I didn't know John Coltrane from Miles Davis. You know, I didn't know, you know, like, reggae to me was, like, Bob Marley, and, like, maybe I knew, like, Augustus Pablo. I didn't know these, I didn't even know about, like, the Heart of the Congos, like, you know, let alone, like, these, like, Arcology, Lee Perry, like, deep, you know, records or whatever, you know. Like, mm-hmm. That was just so formative to me. I think that's kind of lost. I think that was maybe a once in a, you know, not an uncommon thing, you know, to have this, like, you have digital technology that's allowing you to, like, share all this music. But it's before social media, so, like, everyone's just kind of cloistered on these message boards, just been, like, talking about the daily news because we didn't have Twitter, you know, and it was great. Mm-hmm. And I can't, you know, I think so much of, like, my success from that came from being around these, like, really brilliant writers. And some of them went on to great success, and some of them are just geniuses that I don't know where they are. But they were, I mean, it was just an unbelievable collection of geniuses. I guess it speaks volumes about, like, the state of cultural journalism that most of them didn't even want to pursue it or didn't necessarily have the temperament or the patience to pursue it, because it is a slog, and you have to deal with a lot of bullshit, and it's not fun. And, you know, there is, like, an intense blowback when you write something that has an opinion, any kind of opinion. And that's a lot for people to handle, and mm-hmm. I understand that. So basically from there, yeah, a year into it, I via Stylist, I got hired at the LA Weekly. A guy who contributed to Stylist, who's now at the LA Times, who's the writer at the LA Times, Randall Roberts, another person who I owe an immense amount to, gave me a chance at the LA Weekly. And he was just like, write weird, like write whatever you want. So like my first article was, you know, it created a firestorm on the internet at the time. He was, I wrote, he goes, yeah, like, yeah, write a preview of like, fuck it, FYF, back when it was called like, fuck yeah, FS. But he's like, I don't want you to do one of these like, you know, these like puff piece nonsense bullshit things. He's like, give me something real. Like, you know, tell me what you really think. And I was like, okay. I was like, I'm probably the right guy for that. So I did like, fuck yeah, fuck nah, fuck nah. And like, in hindsight, like, yeah, maybe it was stupid and juvenile. Like, yeah, I wouldn't put it in an anthology. Yeah, so I basically said, fuck nah, and it was about this band called Deer Hunter. And, you know, Deer Hunter, to be fair, like, did improve after this. They really did. But I had seen them about 6 months before, and I just thought they were fucking frauds. And, you know, like, I acknowledge that some of their later stuff is, like, it's pretty decent. You know, it's not, I never thought they were a great band, and I just thought they were, like, an overhyped, like, you know, I know they're from Atlanta, but it just seemed like a New York kind of creation. I'd seen them live, and I was like, this band is terrible. I was like, I like experimental music, like, but this, they just suck. You know, I get really mad when people are posturing, and I don't want to come off as a hypocrite, because, you know, I think everybody is probably capable of posturing. You know, like, everything in itself is sort of posturing. You know, like, if you have a digital persona, you are posturing, you know?
Yeah,
and,
of course.
But, you know,
my Instagram, you know, is complete posturing.
Totally. Everyone's Instagram is complete posturing. You know, that's the problem with Instagram. But, like, I don't know how to, like, I mean, I try to be as sincere as I can at all times, but, like, what can you do? Like, it's all, you're never going to be as sincere as you want to be. It's the fucking internet. And you don't want to be corny. Anyways, so, you know, I got mad, and I put them in the fucking nah column, and it had a bunch of, like, Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure and, like, jokes, and I thought, oh, that was fine. I love Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure. I'm probably, like, a L.A. stoner, a Southern California stoner at heart. That was, like, my favorite movement. Let's get that. You know, I made some Bill and Ted's Excellent Adventure jokes. Bradford Cox sent me this email. We went back and forth via email, and then he posted the whole exchange on his blog, and I was like, fuck this motherfucker. You know, and I came from, like, you know, I was... I've never been a person that picks fights. I really don't like to pick fights with people. I hate bullies, but I'm not scared to fight back. You know, as I've gotten older, thankfully, I kind of developed, like, hopefully a certain wisdom where it's like, you know, solve things amicably if you can, you know, like, be it, you know, not to say that I've definitely been, obviously, had my share of controversies and whatever, you know, like, or with artists, but I wrote this, like, really scathing and horribly mean thing, like, about Deer Hunter and, like, just making fun of him, and then he apologized. It was cool. We ended up making mixes for each other on each other's blogs, so it worked out well. We, like, you know, that's how it should be. You know what I mean? Like, even if you... If you go back and forth with someone, like, you know, like, at the end of the day, like, try to be, like, friendly with them. You know, there's like, life is too short to really, like, hold, like, harbor these, like, deep-seated grudges and long enmity over something. I try to, like, not hate anyone, like, even if it might seem that way. Yeah, and that was kind of my first article for the LA Weekly. And my second article was an article on Soulja Boy that ended up being anthologized in the Best American Music Writing Book. Like, concurrently, I got a really, actually a couple months before this, an editor at LA Times. At the time, Kevin Bronson, another person who I, you know, I owe an immense gratitude to. He was like, I'll give you a shot at the LA Times, you know, playing my adult baseball league. And so I did both. And so, yeah, so I guess, like, if I was giving advice to anybody, I would say be good at sports and hope that an editor is playing in an adult league that they need a left-handed pitcher and a left-handed first baseman. So that was, yeah. And then I got into the Times, and, you know, I was ready. I'd been writing for free for 2 years, and, you know, I was 25 at the time, and that was really that. You know, I a lot of people ask, like, oh, how did you get to this place? How did you get to that place? And most of the time, I don't know if I've ever, like, blindly pitched anyone, and I have. That's not true. I have, but it never works out. You know, like, I've been lucky enough to, you know, I've spent so much time writing for Passion and Voice for free. You know, people, like, tell you don't write for free. And, like, I get that. Like, I wouldn't want to write for free for, like, Rolling Stone or something. You know, I think, like, you deserve to get paid. And thankfully, like, we have a Patreon now. And I'm, like, starting to pay the writers that have written for me for a long time. Not every, you know, I'd love to get to the point where, like, everyone gets paid for every article a fraction of what they're worth. But I'm not quite there yet. But, yeah, it was just one of those things where I just kept doing it, and I, you know, there were years where I just never turned down a gig, and no matter how busy I was, and No, I always try to talk to people. I'm like, it requires like a massive sacrifice. You know, there are going to be parts of your life that will be like not normal. You know, like you will like, you know, but that was okay with me when I first started my life. Like to me, writing was everything. That was, I knew that that was the most important thing to me. So I, you know, I asked myself, I was like, well, I think, and I think it's important for people to ask themselves those like honest questions where I was like, okay, well, if you like never make it, like, let's say you never make it as a writer and like, you know, maybe you have a career, but like, you know, would you be okay with doing this if you couldn't have a wife and you couldn't have a family and you couldn't, you know, necessarily take vacations or, you know what I mean? Like a life that like, you're, you know, the desiccated corpse of the American dream looks like in 2018. And there was never really any conflict for me. I was always like, I have to write. Like everything is in service of me being a writer. And, you know, that to me has always wanted to be books and movies, and you know, I wrote a book on Tupac and Biggie and with my brilliant friend Evan McGarvey, but like I've been working on other stuff, and it's really just that's kind of always been the goal, is to kind of to write. And you know, I tell my friends when they get really discouraged, because there's a lot to be discouraged about, I was like, look, like these medieval monks were like not like, you know, like locked up in their towers, like, you know, or like these like Talmudic scholars weren't like writing for the clout. You know, they weren't like, oh, damn, Moshe's midrash on, you know, the book of Leviticus is really, you know, like that wasn't like for the retweets, you know, it was for, you know, I hate the phrase for the love. It's so fucking lame. But, you know, it was for, and I don't like for the culture either, but it was for, you know, like, I mean, it's more pretentious, but it's probably true. It's for the art of it. And like, you know, maybe that is pretentious. And I don't really care at this point about that. Like, we don't prioritize art enough in the society. And what we call art is very often not art. And what we dismiss as like emptiness can be art, you know, and obviously we know that. It's, we're just so far down the rabbit hole of postmodernism that everyone's afraid to like be sincere and honest and like be, you know, like, everyone's terrified to come off as corny, which like, hey, who among us? But I don't know. I just think it's like, I take like my writing, like I try not to take myself seriously, but I do take my writing very seriously. And that's like the only thing I can kind of, that's why I always tell people, I'm like, just don't take yourself seriously. Nothing matters. Like, it's fine. Like you're okay. And like, I've kind of had to settle to like, nothing matters. Like philosophy on life. And I don't mean that literally, obviously. I mean that in the sense where it's like, look, like, there are so many things that are bullshit and, like, irrelevant. Like, the people's perception of you doesn't matter. Like, Twitter doesn't matter. Like, Facebook doesn't matter. Like, Instagram doesn't matter. But through, like, that kind of, like, nothingness, I feel there is something like, okay, well, that means you can do whatever you want. That means there are no rules necessarily to you. So write your own rules and write your own moral code and compass and try to figure out what that means. And then, like, but then at the end of the day, you like, think about it, you're like, ah, we have maybe 20 good years on Earth left, so maybe we'll just smoke that joint, you know? I'll have a double, mm-hmm. please. You know, yes, you know. So
yeah, I want to go back to the blogs, to 2005 a little bit, the golden age of Blogger, etc.
Yeah.
So you started this blog, and you obviously like were like, I'm gonna write about what I love, and you were gonna completely immerse yourself. And did you just start building relationships with these other blogs, or you guys just all
kind
of naturally connected on the same topics, or can you talk a little bit about that? Like,
yeah,
that
I mean, I definitely, like, I remember there was a writer named Alex Blagg who, you know, is like now writing screenplays, and I thought he was the funniest person. He still is incredibly funny. He's on Twitter, and he has a blog called Blagg Blog, and, you know, like, I've talked to Alex, you know, we're like friendly. I was like, man, I loved Blagg Blog. And I maybe that's why my writing was so shitty at first, because I was like totally imitating Alex Blagg. And, but, you know, I wrote to him, and like, he added me to the blog role, and I was like, wow. You know, I was like, that's so cool. And there was like a guy named Mark Rambo, and he had a blog called Whatevs. And like, he would rank all the blogs. And I remember writing to him, and I was like, hey, I'm just like doing this thing, like, whatever, like, maybe I'll think it's funny, maybe not. Like, because it wasn't only music at first. Like, I never, like, wanted to be a music writer. Like, that's the other thing. Like, and honestly, like, I know I write mostly about music, but, like, I've never considered myself a music writer for a day in my life, you know, like, just a writer. And I don't know, that just never made sense to me why anyone would, like, I understand, like, yeah, like, of course, like, I specialize in music writing, and of course, I specialize in hip-hop, and of course, I specialize in West Coast hip-hop, you know what I mean? Like, of course, but, like, that's the stuff I love, and, or I really hate. Yeah, and then I would, you know, I would, who else? I mean, yeah, like, you know, I remember, like, when Sexy Results, Ian Cohen's blog, would, like, link to me, and I get, like, 75 hits, I'd be like, you know, like, it's like the, you know, the cash register, or not the cash register, but like the jackpot sound, and you're like, all the coin, you know, like a huge deal. Yeah, like, of course, like, I was a kid and I like looked up to these people, and I would just, you know, Aquarium Drunkard, like, I got to, I remember, like, wow, all right, I'm doing a show with Aquarium Drunkard, like, that's so cool. And there was like the blog Rock Insider, and it was wonderful, honestly. There was a lot of like camaraderie, and like, especially out in LA, like, there was never, and there never has been, that sense of like competition that I felt like that maybe, and obviously it's projection and the stereotype, but you know, I know a lot of my friends that have been in New York and other East Coast cities, they do feel a real sense of like doggy dog competitiveness. And I've never really felt that in LA. Like, to me, I mean, I don't really like most of the writers in LA, like, that I know, I consider my friends. And like, I mean, I guess that comes in with what we were trying to do with The Land, which is probably like fast forward, but you know, you would get to know these people, especially in the blog era. And they were all really cool. Like, I remember the first time I went to South by Southwest, it was like 2008. I remember meeting like all these bloggers from all over the country. And to me, like, the bloggers were kind of cooler than the critics, because the bloggers just kind of were motivated by this like place of love. And right, critics, like, so, you know, I don't know. I hate that Dave Eggers essay about criticism where he's like, don't be a critic. And you're like, fuck you, Dave Eggers. Like, whatever. Like, sorry. I mean, Dave Eggers has done a lot of good. Like, I'd shake his hand if I met him. But, like, honestly, that essay, like, I would tell him to his face that it was fucking wrong. Because you need criticism. Because without criticism, like, what is real? Like, what is good? What is bad? Like, you need standards in the society. Like, and we've seen what's happened when we don't have standards. You know what I mean? Very clearly. Like, I'm not in favor of gatekeepers, but I'm more in favor of gatekeepers than none at all. You know what I mean? Like, it's just like, we need to have the capacity to like understand complicated ideas and like understand that, like, yes, sometimes there will be a less good option, but it's better. Or, you know, or there's one that's better and neither are good. Yeah, so I got to meet all these bloggers and, you know, and between them and like the stylist people, you know, that, like, I mean, I'm still friends with Justin Gage, you know, he's a great guy. Like, I you know, all the people that I met at that time were still cool. I remember, like, there was a show about a year ago at Spaceland in Silver Lake, and that was, like, mm-hmm. in the L.A. scene, that was, like, the height of it. And it was actually one of the more, like, beautiful kind of moments of the last few years. And music for me was, like, it was this band called The Switch, and the Henry Clay people played, and I forget who else played. Like, I'm blanking right now, but those were, like, the two that kind of stand out. Oh, of course, the Parson Redheads, who were, like, one of my favorite L.A. psychedelic rock bands at the time, of course. They, like, they came back into town for the show. And they put together, like a 2007, like, throwback show. And it was just amazing. And, like, that was, like really, like, I don't know, like, scenes matter, you know? And just, but, like, build a good one. You know, like build the scene you want. Don't build the scene, like, don't build the scene that, you know, you build the scene you need, not the scene you want. You know, like, build the scene that, like makes you feel complete and, like, around good people, and you feel like you're doing something positive. And, like, it's not rooted in negativity. It's not rooted in competition, you know? And so, yeah, all these people, it felt like that. You know, I remember going to Spaceland and, like, getting drunk in the back room and, like, smoking cigarettes and, like, thinking, like, that was awesome. You know, I was like, all right, I'm an adult now. Like, going to Fred 62 afterwards and, like, eating, like, these, like tuna sandwiches the size of my head, like, you know, at, like, 3 a.m. But that was...
their mac and cheese
box. You know, when I, yeah, oh, God, yeah, exactly. I used to have those mac and cheese every time. So good. But, yeah, and that was the scene, right? And I just... And it's cool, and it's evolved, you know, when, like, I love, like, when things... Like, to me, the most meaningful scene I've been a part of was probably the Low End Theory scene. And that, you know, it's kind of a tragedy how it kind of ended, but, you know, like, a beautiful tragedy in many respects, because it did bring so much, like, light and joy and, like, innovation into the world. And, you know, going to Low End Theory from, like 08, 09 until, like, I don't know, 2015, 2016, all the time, like, every single Wednesday, practically, that to me was just another musical education. And it was amazing to kind of be a part of it, you know, even as a journalist, you know, because there was no divide, you know, there wasn't this, like, Hollywood bullshit VIP. I hate that shit. I grew up in, like, on the west side of LA. I fucking hated that shit. I hated the Hollywood aspect of it. I hated the egos. I hated the fucking, the empty money. You know, it's like, money's not bad, but, like, the way that, like, money's not inherently bad, but the way it's wielded as a form of, like, I'm better than you. Like, that to me is disgusting. And it always has been. And cause I saw it growing up. And that's why I like the writer, like, F. Scott Fitzgerald, because he had this, like, kind of complicated view of money. Cause he grew up, like, you know, someone once described him as, like, the little kid that, you know, was, like, his nose pressed outside like the window while these like rich people were like eating these fancy meals. He was like wondering how much it all cost and, you know, that sort of thing. Because I grew up in kind of that world and I have a lot of disdain for it, even though some of those people are like my friends and like nothing personal, you know. It's like I can be friends with those type of people. I don't think that's like everyone has different interests. But to me, that was always, and Low End Theory to me represented the opposite of the LA cliche. You know, it represented like this, like what LA was becoming.
Sorry to interrupt, but can you explain?
Yeah.
I'm going to have listeners that aren't going to know what Low End
Theory
is.
Of course, yeah, yeah.
In relation to LA.
Of course, yeah, it's
a good
question.
It's the Tribe Called Quest album.
No, totally, right. So the Low End Theory was a collective and a venue and a club night, obviously called Low End Theory, and it was every Wednesday night at the Airliner, and it was basically, out of it came a form called beat music, which is kind of, I guess, ironic in hindsight, because like the beat generation and beat music ended up being like a whole thing of my life. So it was like, it's kind of a guy, you know. But it basically was, you know, five resident DJs would play every week. I guess there were four resident DJs. I'm miscounting. There were five residents, and No Candy was the rapper. And they'd play every week, and it started out kind of like, you know, like playing like a lot of DJ Shadow and J Dilla and like Daubry and Radiohead and like this. And it became, so like through this like syncretic, like process, it became its own sound, and then you started to produce people like Flying Lotus was already around, Daedalus was already around, but then you produced like No Such Thing and Teebs and Monopoly and these like producers that were like carving up hip hop into like this like kind of part electronic, part psychedelic, part, you know, dubstep, like early British dubstep was coming in, like heavy bass music, you know. And it was just, it became this like new kind of indigenous form of like LA kind of instrumental hip hop productions. And you would go every Wednesday. And at first there was like no line. Like at first it was just like a bunch of like bros and like, you know, like just like high as fuck, you know, like smoking blunts and just like listening to music and like just vibing out. And then eventually it became like this incredible party, you know, like Tom York played there and like Tyler the Creator and Odd Future had their first show there. And Erykah Badu played there. And like Prince showed up one night and it was just this, you know, beautiful, like collage of like LA culture, you know, like all races, all, you know, and ethnicities, you know, they'd have 18-year-olds there and like 35-year-olds and 40-year-olds, you know, it just didn't matter, you know, everyone was just really, it was a really like, as far as anything could be pure and be good, Low End Theory was kind of that. It was, you know, some of the, like, probably honestly, like, you know, it was like a once in a lifetime thing. It was like, you know, I imagine it was like what the Hacienda in Manchester was like. I imagine it was like what Ibiza was, you know, when like DJ Harvey was out there in the early 90s. I imagine it was, yeah, I guess it was, you know, Paul Oakenfold. I'm not really a Paul Oakenfold guy, but I'm sure it was great. You know, I'm sure it was like the same feeling that, you know, people had at CBGB in like 76, you know, and that was Low End Theory from about 2009 to about 2015. So I was like, that to me was like a really incredibly indelible thing for me.
So you've been super, super immersed in the whole West Coast hip hop rap scene. Can you talk about that, given you're kind of like the old guard? Can you talk about that now in terms of how hip hop is quote unquote dominating the charts? Talk about that in relation to kind of what you know, your experience.
I mean, to me, it's always been the music. So, I mean, like, yeah, like, I liked indie rock in the 2000s. I loved grunge in the 90s. And, like, I like R&B and, you know, like, all kinds of music. But, I mean, hip-hop to me, it's just they have a more accurate way to calculate it now. It's just now they have a metric for it with streaming. I mean, it always was. I mean, Master P was selling a billion records in the late 90s. Like, Puffy was selling a billion records. You know, like, yeah, like, I guess it was, like, nu metal. And now it's, like, other genres have like faded away into kind of like black, you know, not as popular, but it's been the dominant form. I mean, it's been like the way that people speak is like completely irrevocably altered by hip hop, you know, it's everything. And I still think it's, you know, is it as great as it was in the 90s? Like probably not, but still great. Like, and you know, I love a lot of like young, I mean, the LA artists right now, like I fuck with like all of the shit coming out of LA right now. Like I love Blueface. I love Drake. Drake is like my favorite rapper alive. You know, O3 Greedo, free him and Draco are like my favorite rappers. Shoreline Mafia are great. This kid Rucci out of Inglewood is incredible. There's just so much. I mean, One Take J is great. There's so many amazing talents out of LA right now. Like, I mean, it's the best time for it to be like to, you know, I wish there were more publications to write for, you know, in LA, like that cared about LA rap and paid like a living wage, you know, like a real, unfortunately, it's just the LA Times right now. And, you know, like I love the LA Times and like, I love a lot of people there. And, but it's, I wish there were like four more publications, because it's a shame that like, there's not
a way to kind of, you know, some artists aren't national. And, like, I don't blame, like, editors at national publications for not wanting to take a story about a rapper that only makes sense in L.A. but is huge. You know, like, eventually, obviously, if you get big enough and you cross over nationally, like, fine, like, it makes sense. But so we have a night called Don't Come to L.A., which is, like, not on a hiatus, but we took a couple months off, but we're about to relaunch it again at the top of the year. But, yeah, that's me and my partner with it, Rosecrans Vic, who's an amazing young guy who's just kind of – he's going to take over. He's going to be the next big – you know, I'm sure he's going to do something amazing with his life, like music mogul of some sort. And he has a site called Rosecrans Avenue, and it's sort of like kind of what I was saying, right? Like Vic and me kind of like, I guess, like, you know, I'm always like looking around and maybe liked a tweet of mine or something. And I was like, oh, what's Rosecrans Avenue? And I like looked at it. I was like, oh shit. Like, he's writing about a lot of like music I don't know about, like from like LA street rap. And I was like, that's cool. I've been waiting for this for a long time. And then he was just, like, a great dude and like not a competitive person and like kind of just wanted to kind of like help and like be a part of, you know, like he was just about like being a part of, you know, the culture that was kind of like flourishing. And we kind of linked up and I was like, dude, like there's not a place to go see rap. You know, Low End Theory was closing and Funkmasphere had closed, and we were just like, man, we need to do like a night, like where we can like monthly, where we can just have all these artists that are just blowing up and like have them play and, you know, create the scene that we wanted to, that we needed to see. And, you know, we did, and we're in very much in the part of continuing that. But yeah, it's been great. It's been really cool. I wish that there, all my only complaint is that there's not, you know, hopefully the land can, you know, start to fill in some of the blanks. But that Bland is, you know, we haven't talked about it, but it's a magazine I'm launching with some really, really, really talented people from that were, you know, part of the LA Weekly, the Boycott LA Weekly movement, and it kind of became something more positive. You know, I'm a big believer in people talk about, like, no, don't be negative. That's stupid to me. I think negativity is important, but it has to lead to positivity in the end. You know, it can't just stay negative. You know, it has to be productive. You know, it's like, all right, take what you don't like. Be mad. You know, and but channel your anger, you know, and that's sort of, I guess, like kind of been like a philosophy of mine. It's like, you know, it's don't just like be negative, you know, because that shit will eat you alive if you let it stay negative. Like you channel into creativity, channel into creation, you know.
Talk about, if you can, just a little bit, because, you know, again, I don't think people outside of L.A. really know what, you know, what went down with L.A. Weekly, which was the ultimate alt weekly newspaper in Los Angeles and around Southern California. And
yeah, for sure.
Yeah, talk a little bit about the magazine that you're going to be launching.
Basically, LA Weekly had been, yeah, like it had been like the preeminent progressive voice for Los Angeles for the previous 40 years. It had ups and downs. No one will deny that. There were good periods. There were bad periods. There were periods somewhere in between. But ultimately, it was, you know, by the time the LA Weekly closed, or it's still technically open, but like no one other than like the biggest like scab or like, you know, Trumpist, like delusional lunatic actually thinks it exists. But basically, at the end of 2016, it got bought by basically like more or less a cabal of Republican operatives from Orange County. No one knew who they were. They were completely secret. One of the guys was revealed to like later have been the vice president of the Claremont Institute, which the New York Review books famously called Trump's brains. They had, you know, they'd given to like the Trump victory campaign. They, you know, all these like right-wing causes, you know, like one guy was in Cubans for Trump on Facebook. It was this, you know, I like, they had a PAC in Orange County, like called Gen Next, which was like anti-terrorism. And you look at it and you're like, for the last like 12 years, they've only, they give like 99.9% to like Republican candidates. Like many of them were very far right. And then they bought the LA Weekly. They fired everyone in the most cowardly fashion. They had, like, emailed the publisher to tell him to tell the editor. And then the editor, Marichal Hoop, an amazing, amazing woman and editor, had to, like, tell everyone one by one, like execution style. You know, it was, like, really disgusting. And they didn't even have the backbone or integrity to even be in the building or be like, thank you for your service. We're going in a different direction. No exit interviews, nothing. They just like liquidated it. You know, it was just despicable people. And then I basically, you know, myself and the former film critic and editor, April Wolf, was a big voice in it, and a bunch of other people eventually joined us. But we were just screaming on Twitter about what a crime this was. And not just a crime to, you know, like, obviously, like, people lost their jobs, and that's very sad. I mean, it was like 2 weeks before Christmas, you know, it was like, it's really horrible on a moral level, but really what was, to me, it was the greatest crime was what it was doing to the city of L.A., what it was doing to, you know, civic life and public discourse and, like, you know, and moreover, like, the artists that, you know, the artists and they're not being covered, you know, that wouldn't get their story told, the politicians. that we're going to get a go with, you know, immense corruption, you know, that just the ignorance that would be allowed to flourish. And, you know, you need the press, a strong, healthy, like vigorous press as like, as a check, you know, it's a necessary check and balance in culture. And, you know, so I do believe, it's like why I believe in a negative review occasionally. Like, you need that. Like, that is just, like, it's just how it goes. And, like, fine, like, you know, whatever. Someone can write something back about how they don't like what you're doing, and that's fine. That's how it goes. And so anyways, with the LA Weekly, we formed a boycott movement. We got a few of their events shut down. We basically kind of backed them into a corner and just got them to the point where, you know, one of their investors was suing another, you know, one of their investors, who apparently was actually the only decent person. He was the only LA native or LA resident that bought the group, suing the rest of the investors in the hopes of dissolving the company for breathtaking incompetence. And I was cited in the lawsuit, in the complaint of the lawsuit, in the first paragraph. And the quote was, "You can't be an alt weekly when the city hates you." And that was my point. And, you know, like, conversely, like, we basically, you know, spend like 6 months, like, really fighting them. And, you know, on some level, like, as long as they're called Seminole Media, as long as Seminole Media owns the LA Weekly, they're an enemy. And they need to be destroyed, because they don't care about the city of Los Angeles. They don't, you know what I mean? And like, that to me is like the ultimate crime. You need to be, you are a part of the community that you live in, whether you like it or not. You need to understand that. There are social mores. There's direction. There's, like, you know, LA is a street by street, block by block city. You know, the colors change on each block. You know, it is a city of, you know, I don't know, like Dorothy Parker's like stupid quote about like, oh, LA is a city like with 72 suburbs searching for a city. But it's like, no, it's like 72 small cities at this point. And they would never understood that. They never could understand that. They just have a bunch of people that are just either so, like, desperate and sad and pathetic that they have to keep on running for the LA Weekly, or they're just completely, like, I mean, they're all actually really tremendously untalented people, but, and they're all, like, so cynical that they can't believe in anything. They can't, you know what I mean? Rather than fight for what they believe, you know, fight for what obviously everyone knew was right. I mean, everyone in the city of LA who had, like, a pulse, understood that it was unconscionable for a bunch of, like, right-wing Republican operatives from Orange County to destroy this, like, amazing Los Angeles publication. And so we're trying, you know, what we're doing with the Land magazine is a magazine that a bunch of us have started in the wake of the boycott is you know, it's not going to be, it's not going to be a weekly, but something that does contribute and is positive and shines a light on these people that need to have, you know, that don't, you know, where the news cameras don't necessarily come, you know, and we're not trying to, like, we're trying to just be something that is, like, valuable for the culture and city itself, and hopefully just be a positive force. Because I think that's, like, you know, it's not about necessarily, like, solving the problems, but it's making them a little bit less intractable, and, you know, just improving things a little bit. And hopefully the Land magazine can improve things a little bit. You know, I'd never, like, make the case that we're, like, saviors. But, I mean, really, hopefully my dream is to just kind of inspire other journalists in other cities to do that, you know, like, understand that, like, look, sometimes you have to kind of just, like, take a risk and sacrifice your time and maybe a little bit of your money and, like, for something you believe in, to create something that hopefully, like, can, you know, because, like, we forget, like, I'm like, I don't know, like, granted, print journalism is a loss leader at best, but there were people that did this, you know, like, all the great publications came from somewhere, you know, like, the Village Voice came from a bunch of people together being like, let's start a magazine, you know, let's do it. And I think, like, you have to have that attitude. Like, we can't let ourselves be too cynical. We can't let ourselves get too degraded by the brutish idiocy of our culture, because that's the reality of it. We do live in like, idiot times. You know, it's like the Bob Dylan's, like, idiot wind. It's like, the idiot winds are strong. The idiot winds are Santa Ana's right now. But, like, it doesn't mean that, like, you have to, like, get blown off the overpass, you know, like, just, we have to stay strong and focused and disciplined and, like, remember what's right. And I'm far from perfect. I would never try to posit myself as, like, some perfect angel or any kind of thing like that. Like, I'm just trying to do the best I can as often as I can. And, like, sometimes I fail and sometimes I'm not, you know, I'm not, like, as good as I'd like to be, but it's not, if I'm anything, it's like, I'm not going to sit here and, like, just watch, like, everyone take L's. Like, I'm not going to take an L personally. Like, I mean, I might, but, like, I'm going to keep fighting. And I think, like, we have to have that spirit, because I think, I mean, like, not to get, like, corny, like, patriotism, but, like, I don't know, like, America, like, to me, like, I identify with, like, you know, on some level, like, I'm from a lineage of Jews. Like, my own personal thoughts on the religion or whatever, like, kind of are material. But the thing that inspires me about, like, coming from that lineage is the Jews were always a people of rebels. They were people of words and, you know, a people of words and rebellion. You know, it's like a series of people trying to, like, conquer you and conquer you. And then finally it's a Holocaust, which should have conquered, you know, and then, like, it didn't. And it like, you know, it's a people like what I would consider have an indomitable will. And sometimes that can be a detriment for sure, you know, to be make a broad generalization. But that to me is super inspiring. And like, I guess like that is something I think about a lot, just kind of, you know, trying to kind of just keep fighting because unfortunately we have to. Like, I'd love to see a day when we don't, but the day is not here right now.
Are you able to, with the shuttering of these types of like publications, how are you able to keep writing? What's your outlook right now for the media landscape? Like, how do you still make a living, essentially?
I mean, I'm really lucky, and I came in at a time, like, you know, I'm really lucky, and I work incredibly hard. Like, you know, I don't go out most nights anymore. You know, I wish I could, like, I you know, but I can't. You know, I have to you know, I have a website, Compassionate Wise, that I run every morning, and I have to tweet out the stories and, like, deal with emails and deal with pitches and edit the writers, and I still do that every day. And in the afternoon, I try to, like, I'll either do an interview or I'll have to, like, have a meeting. I mean, on a dream interview, I just, on a dream day, I guess just like go to the gym or something and I can go home and take a nap and like read for an hour or two. And then, you know, I get up and I have to write all night, you know, and sometimes that, you know, like a treat for me is like a couple hours I can read and I can maybe like watch a basketball game on like an illegal Reddit stream, you know, like, but like, that's okay. I'll, you know, I go out, like I get to travel a lot for work. That's really exciting. I mean, I write for, like, you know, I write a lot for the Washington Post. I write for Pitchfork, you know, sometimes, like, whenever, you know. So I have a story for Playboy coming out, you know, I have a story for Variety coming out. I mean, I'm lucky. I've been doing this for a long time. You know, hopefully, like, my editors know that, like, I take an incredible amount of pride in what I write. You know, not everything is sterling, but, you know, everything hopefully is clean when I turn it in and thoughtful. And, you know, there's never a sentence or never a word that isn't considered. I think about everything really deeply, or I don't know how well, but I do think about it hard, you know. I don't know if it's deep, but I think about it hard. Mm-hmm. Yeah, so I am able to make a living. You know, I have a record label, POW Recordings, with a bunch of artists that, you know, I just, like, try to, like, surround, you know, it's, I try to surround myself with, like, people and artists and that I believe in and that I respect, and, like, hopefully it comes back around. You know, like, the writers are right for Passion the White. So it's, like, again, like, some of my closest friends, you know, like, those are, like, my kind of, like, my brothers and sisters. I wish we had more female writers. If anyone's listening, we would love more female writers. And we're always looking for, like, different perspectives. So, like, you know, I've tried to do a good job of, you know, having as many perspectives as we can and trying to be diverse, even though we barely pay anything, which I think it's important to me. And, you know, it doesn't want to be one of those things where you're, like, you know, it's be, like, my nightmare to be, like, it's 30 white guys writing about rap. And you're, like, no. You're, like, that's the worst. But, you know, so we're just trying, you know, I just try to, like, do that, and I just work really hard, and, you know, I'm lucky that, you know, I hustle. You know, you have to hustle sometimes, you know, like, sometimes you end up writing, like, a bio or something. I don't really like writing bios, but sometimes, like, you know, like, there's, like, I'll write a bio for someone I like, you know, and, you know, you'll get paid, or, like, you'll do, you know, it's just, you know, trying to just keep going. And, you know, I'm lucky that I haven't, you know, most writers that freelance, I mean, it's almost an impossible thing. You know, it's sometimes I'm just staggered, you know, I've been technically, like, unemployed for 12 years now. So that's, you know, I haven't had a day job in the last 12 years. And I mean, I've been offered day jobs, you know, like cool editing positions, you know, or like writer jobs. And I don't know, maybe I'll take one day, but I don't really see myself doing it. I've kind of always seen myself as kind of I've always been one of those people that, you know, never was necessarily had one group of friends. I had like five groups of friends, you know, and like maybe those five groups of friends, like, weren't necessarily friends with each other, but, like, you know, I don't know. I think that's served me well in journalism though, because it teaches you kind of to hopefully appreciate and understand different ideas and perspectives. And, you know, it's something I'm always trying to work on and improve, because, you know, like, being like, I mean, I don't know, Jews, obviously, like, you know, being Jewish, it's like not necessarily like you're like a white dude from Iowa, but obviously I would say that, like, you know, as a white person, you know, as a white appearing person, like, you definitely benefit from white privilege. And, you know, it's something you have to acknowledge, I think, when you're writing about rap, especially, and you're dealing with black culture and, like, understanding what you don't know. Which is a lot. I mean, there's a ton of stuff I don't know. And so I try to, you know, like, listen as much as I can and understand as much as I can, you know, because I don't know, I think it does, like, matter. Like, we are, it's, like, one of the good things about this time is that we are at a time now we are finally, like, starting to listen to other people and other perspectives that might have gotten bulldozed over in the past. So, yeah, so it's a constant series of trying to check myself and, like, stop being a dick, you know, like, just, like, don't, like, try to listen more and talk less. And but obviously, you know, you can hear me, I talk probably too much. It's probably one of my strengths and total weaknesses. Good on podcasts.
Yeah, you know. Great on podcasts. Final question. If somebody day and age with, you know, I don't know, blogs are kind of, I don't know if blogs are still as paramount, but what would you suggest?
Yeah, they're kind of, they're kind of endangered.
Yeah, so how do people start out? Like, what's your kind of takeaway on that?
I mean, you know, if you want to see, if you want an editor that's not all in the video, dancing, come to Passion of the Wife, you know? Yeah, I would tell them, like, write for my site, like, for free for a while, and then, like, if you get good, like, pay a little bit, and if you get good, better than that, then, like, go write for a big magazine, you know what I mean? Like, that's what it is. I mean, I can't even tell you how many writers I've, like, you know, I don't want to say put on, because, like, they put themselves on, but, like, I mean, I've definitely helped, like, dozens of writers, and that, like, to me, that is, like, something, like, I am as proud of helping all these writers as I am of anything in my career. Like, that to me, like, to see someone go to, like, get a gig at Pitchfork, or then, you know, like, just recently, like, a writer that had been doing a New York rap column called Beautiful Noise, and it was a really great column, and a writer named Alphonse Pierre, he's like a 22-year-old kid out of Staten Island, super, super smart, super funny, just like an amazing talent, and just got hired at Pitchfork, and he'd been writing for me for like 2 years, and you know, when he first came in, he was like still in college, and he's obviously raw, and you're like, this guy's really smart, how can I like help like get him to the point where he like is ready to kind of like, you know, so to like leave the nest, you know? And he did. And I'm so happy and proud to see that happen. And like every time he writes an article that like everyone talks about on the internet, I'm like, you know, that to me is like, you know, I'm like silently, you know, I'm like kind of beaming. You know, that makes me really happy. Mm-hmm. And I think like, you know, I think that like we have to get over the sense of competitiveness like as writers, you know, it's like, I understand that it is a limited resources, limited money. I get jealous sometimes too. Sometimes a writer that I like, a friend of mine will get a really great gig and I'm like, fuck, why didn't they hit me up? But like, you kind of have to like let that go. You know, you kind of have to like be like mad for like 10 seconds and be like really happy for the other person. And I try to like think like that as much as I can. So yeah, I would say that like that would be my best advice if you really someone was trying to write. I mean, I'm like biased. Otherwise, I would just say do it for your fucking self and get good. That's what I did. Like I wrote for Passion of the Wife for years and no one gave a fuck other than like 100 bloggers, you know? And then you just do it and do it and do it and then you get better and like read. That's the other thing I would just say is just like read and don't read music writing. Like don't read the internet. Like read books, you know? Like I've like read, I mean, I try to, I mean, I'm there's certainly so many more people that are more well-read than me, but I try to read as much as I can. It's one of my favorite things to do. And I love writing too, you know, if I had nothing to do on any given day, like I would just be writing. That's like, you know what I mean? I'd be writing for myself. I'd be writing the journal. I'd be reading. That's what I'd like to do, you know? And like, if you don't like to do it, then do something else because like there are many, many better professions. Like this is not a good profession, you know? I mean, my dad told me that from the get-go. He's like, you picked a terrible profession. I'm like, I know. Like I never thought it was a good profession. This was a profession I had to do. This was a path I had to take. I didn't have a choice in the matter. I tried to explain to my dad. I was like, it's just you're born this way, Dad. And he was just like, go to law school, you know? And, yeah, I mean, I wish I could say he was right, you know, being a lawyer would be tight, you know? I mean, it would be horrible, but like, I'd have like a house probably, you know? And I guess the other thing is like, you know, don't like desire less, you know, like desire only like what matters to you, you know? Don't like have these ambitions. Don't be like deluded by like these materialistic, like, kind of, oh, like, somebody's bawling, and, like, you know, it's like, your happiness is all that matters to you, right? Like, most of the people I knew that were growing up that had money, like, weren't happy, you know? And, like, I knew, like, plenty of, like, you know, like, you travel around the world and you see that, like, happiness is not dependent on how much money you have, which is the dumbest, most obvious thing, but, like, realistic. And unfortunately, in America, we live in a time where it's, like, it kind of is, right? Because, like, how can, if you can't afford to pay your rent, then you're kind of are inherently going to be unhappy. That's, like, a huge problem with America. You know, and, like, take another job or, like, don't be too proud to kind of, like, write a bio or something. You know, like, everyone has to kind of hustle. You know, it's an unfortunate reality. I mean, I wish we lived in a world where there was, like, a universal basic income, and like you could just, yeah. Whereas like I was just in Berlin, and that was amazing because I was like, what? Like you're paying how much for rent? Like $600 a month for rent? What? Like that would be amazing. I don't know. I don't know if I don't end up expatriating, which like I'm probably too lazy to do because I don't know where I'd even go. I mean, I'd love to go to Portugal, but just like we have to just just kind of keep that, like, the one thing I would tell them is, like, don't get discouraged. Like, don't let anyone tell you, like, if you have something, like, no one can see what's inside of you. You know, like, when they draft an NBA player, like, they don't know. Like, they think. You know what I mean? Everyone knew LeBron would be good, but no one knew Damian Lillard would be that good. And, like, so much of it is just, like, if you do what you have to do for yourself. Like, write that book. Like, fuck it. Like, just work a day job and, like, write a book at night, you know, and, like, do what you have to do because you're going to die anyway. So it's, like, you might as well, like, you know, nothing matters, right? Like, so if nothing matters, then just get your basic necessities handled and just, like, just do it, you know, because time, you know, like, you're not getting any younger, so.
Yep. Well, I so appreciate your time. I'm glad we finally nailed down this interview, and I think.
Yeah, my pleasure. Thank you for your patience. If you're a writer that wants to write for me, you know, hit me up on Twitter or Instagram. I'm at Passion Weiss, and you know my label's POW Recordings. We have like a SoundCloud. I'm like, I love the rappers on the label and other artists. You know, they're not all rappers. I'm their biggest fan. Obviously, PassionWeiss.com. You know, the Land Magazine. That's it.
Don't forget your book.
Yeah, I got the Tupac and Biggie book, but like buy it used on Amazon because fuck that company. They like a bunch of fucking con men. That's that. But the Land Magazine, I'm really excited about that too. That's like the most immediate thing, and that comes out mid-December. So it'll be available free in LA, and it'll be available online too. And, you know, we're having a fundraiser. Like, we'll probably have one in December. I don't know when this is going to air, but if it's in December, keep, you know, follow me on Twitter or Instagram to kind of see more info. But yeah, I hope everyone likes it.
My special thanks again to Jeff Weiss for being on Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? Again, you can find him on the online magazine Passion of the Weiss or follow him on Twitter at Passion Weiss, PassionWeiss, or you can follow, and or I should say, you can follow the Land Magazine also on Twitter to be apprised of their launch date at the Land Magazine. So chances are, if you are someone who is immersed in LA culture, you know exactly who Jeff Weiss is. So now all of you are in the know. Okay, babies, thus ends another week of Hey, How'd You Get That Music Job? Today is the 13th of November. If you are listening to this on the 13th, I have a show. I will be performing tonight at Bar Lubitsch in WeHo. So if you want to come on out and hear some synth pop music by yours truly, then come on out. I would love, love, love to see you. My website is lariel-music.com. That's lariel-music.com. Or you can follow me on social media at lariel-music. Okay, babies, take good care. Have a wonderful week. Keep on keeping on. And remember, we're all going to keep on hustling, pursue that dream, and don't you dare give up.